everyone. Today we have with us Sarthak Ahuja. Now, before I give a brief intro about him, I'd like to speak a little bit about myself. So I guess I was 23, right, when I graduated. And mind you, I'd only done my undergrads back when I was 23. And at that tender age, I was just trying to figure out, you know, like, now that I have done my undergrads, what should I do next? Should I go for a professional degree or master's or something like that, right? But today we have with us Sarthak Ahuja, who has had a list of degrees to his name all by the age of 23. CA, CS, CMA, and a bachelor's in financial and investment analysis from DU. All, I repeat again, by the age of 23. And today, with about, I think, 10 years of experience in areas like tax advisory, startup consulting, fundraising, audits, or business modeling, deal advisory, and the like. He also has his own contract CFO services, by the way. He is literally everywhere. You name a particular sector in the financial field and he is going to be there. Also, TEDx, Business Standard, Financial Express, you name the platform and he's left a mark on each. So all credit, I think, to the digital revolution or the pandemic, but he comes with the bragworthy tag of virtual CFO to his name. So I think Sarthak is none other than someone who can, you know, literally personify the phrase "been there, done that." So welcome on board, Sarthak. Darshan and I are absolutely delighted and honored to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Charmi, for a very wonderful introduction. To be very honest, none of this was actually planned in terms of doing what by what age. I think a great deal of recognition and acknowledgement of the fact that we all come with very privileged backgrounds where things are probably offered to us and given to us, and we don't even realize how much we really get from God Almighty or the universe. So I think all credit to having found myself in the right place at the right time, and no credit to any kind of self-work, in all honesty. But thank you. Those were very kind words.
So I think the number of degrees that you hold and the number of startups in India, both are endless. So can you take us through some of the, you know, startups that you are a part of or you have been invested in?
So, you know, how openly a few people really talk about, you know, their investments or their involvement in certain companies also at times worries me that if the same question were to be asked to me, maybe having studied corporate law and actually having gone through all these clauses and contracts, a lot of times the confidentiality clause really comes to haunt me. And I'm always wary of who can I really name and who can I not on public platforms. But to be honest, I, as an investor of my own money, this is very contrary to the investment, to the industry that I'm part of. I invest most of my money in index funds and ETFs. So I'm a very, you would say, safe investor from that perspective, because I feel while generating alpha in finance is possible, but it takes a great deal of time, effort, and luck to be able to get that. As they say, you know, 95% of the funds are unable to beat the index. So I feel the amount of time that it would go into me discovering alpha or finding someone who can get alpha for me could probably be better utilized in just upskilling myself and, you know, kind of adding to my body of knowledge, which might give me some kind of self-actualization or feeling of achievement, which is why I am a very safe investor. I park most of my surplus funds in index funds and ETFs, which is why angel investment or startup investment as a category does not fit my investing strategy. Though I'm lucky to have gotten quite a lot of advisor equity in a bunch of startups where I'm an advisor. And I think that is that's the only form of equity I have in privately held companies other than my own. And there is one startup where I've just written a very small check. And it's a profitable company. It's a company which has been running for the past 8 years. I love the brand. And it's a small sum. I feel it will, this is more because of my love for my brand than rather than thinking that my investment will really make a reasonable difference or a material difference in their journey. So yeah, that's that. And I think the PR for it will come out soon. So before that, I'm not allowed to speak about it. So as and when it does, I think people will be interested to see what brand this is.
Okay, fair enough. I understand the confidentiality clause and everything that's, you know, put in place. But I love the fact that you mentioned about alpha, right? So investors today who are wise enough understand that it's very important if you want to gain alpha over a period of time, it's very important to start early, right? And I mean, you began at 23, right? So I don't think, I mean, I understand that, you know, for people like me who are 27, 28 currently, that 23 sounds like, you know, a number that shit, dude, I could have achieved so much in the last 6 years. So what do you consider, like India also, if I have to consider the, with respect to the startup culture in India, do you feel that, you know, India started early or India is lagging, still lagging back despite having so many unicorns? Or what's your take on the startup culture in India? I would like to divide that into two questions. One, your personal take on it, like since the time it started, since about say 4-5 years. And second, at any point of time, did you ever feel that the startup culture is a bubble or something like that? So if you could please walk us through that.
See, honestly, I think it is the time for India, for the entire world to come to India for several reasons. One, of course, the human capital and their potential is immense. I feel on a lot of aspects, China is definitely way ahead of us in terms of productivity, in terms of intelligence, in terms of efficiency. However, purely owing to the fact that they're kind of a closed economy, a lot of people external to China have not been able to enter them. And China is more outward looking in terms of, you know, wanting to invest their money in different countries rather than letting, you know, foreign investment come in. That notwithstanding, I think India has definitely made its mark. And I think it all started, as we all know, with Flipkart. You know, Flipkart, one of the early startups, InMobi, you know, those guys and you know, as they have the PayPal mafia in Silicon Valley and in the US, they have the Flipkart mafia. A lot of people who are ex-Flipkart, you know, the wealth that they generated from all the ESOPs and all the money that the company could generate for them actually started this trickle-down effect in a wave where those people were inspired to move out and start working on their own ventures and pay it forward, you know, in the form of a culture. So I think culturally, it's amazing. Entrepreneurship, the very fact that people want to innovate, solve problems, and create jobs for people is amazing. I feel there is a lot more to happen in India. And we've just scraped the surface in the past, 5 to 8 years. However, I do feel that purely basis overarching macroeconomic factors, such as, you know, the capital availability and allocation cycles. What has happened in the past 2 years has been an anomaly. I know of a lot of companies that I have closely been associated with to have used funds on things like marketing, where the marketing spend would have probably increased by 2 times or 3 times with hardly any change in the revenue. So, you know, the efficiency of utilization of capital has definitely not translated in the way, you know, the founders expected it to be. And it's not generated that kind of impact. And bubbles come in when there is lack of efficiency and there is excess of capital, which has definitely been a macroeconomic, point in the past two years or so. So I wouldn't blame India for that in any way. I think it's the global economic climate. But yes, there has definitely been a bubble and there will definitely be a correction. People were saying it even in the past, but of course it starts with the public markets. So we all know that at the current point at which we're having this conversation, you know, tech stocks around the world are down 60-70% on an average. And of course, that permeates to even smaller companies because the risk is higher. As the risk is higher, of course, the impact is also going to be manifold, which is why I feel that, yes, it may bring in a lull for the next 1 year or so. But that also gives an opportunity to filter off the chaff and only have those businesses who have a sustainability mindset and an efficiency mindset rather than just injecting capital into the business for growth.
So with over 60,000 startups and 107 unicorns, I think we have solved a lot of problems. And the startup ecosystem is a very important asset to the Indian economy's goal of, I think, of $5 trillion. So apart from tech, which other sectors do you feel that the startup ecosystem will be evolving in the near future?
You know, I mostly borrow this answer from Andreessen Horowitz, which is A16Z, is popularly known as a VC firm, based out of the US. And they say that there are basically three sectors that they are really bullish on, which is ABC. A being AI and artificial intelligence, B being biotechnology, and C being crypto and Web3. I personally don't understand much of crypto and Web3. Despite all the reading I've done on the subject, I do feel that there are a lot of information gaps, which is why I kind of reserve a lot of comments on the industry. Biotech sounds really interesting to me, that how using nanotechnology and how using technology, a lot of problems in the human body can probably be solved much better than they were initially. So I definitely see that as a big trend, which will boom in the future. Also, because if you look at, your absolute primitive need, you go down to first principles, you realize that having a long life and having a long and healthy life is one of the most innate human needs, much before education and everything else kind of comes into play. From that point of view, biotech, huge potential. It has in the past required a lot of R&D money and a lot of capital infusion to really make a dent. I feel now that kind of capital, if channeled in the right areas, can definitely give biotech a boom. The third one, artificial intelligence, I feel there is so much on GPT-3, on Lex, on DALL-E, on Deepfake, Descript, Rephrase. These are companies which are doing some amazing work using AI. And I myself am thrilled. I keep trying to use AI tools to see what part of my daily life can I really solve for and in a better way, which is why I'm most excited by AI and then also by biotech. Web3, of course, will take its course, and I'll let the experts speak about that topic in more depth.
Right. So you talking about AI, right? I am not a very tech. I'm not a techie basically. So, but I did study about OpenAI, DALL-E, and stuff like that. So sometimes it makes me wonder that if softwares like DALL-E, Jasper, and the likes come into picture, as we head out into the next generation, next era of content creation, do you think that they will how much do you think will they be taking over the jobs of content creators per se? Because it is wonderful how these softwares can magically curate long essays out of just 5 phrases that I give to the software, right? So what is your take on the job of human content creators today, and how will that pan out?
Well, I think, it's one thing is looking at content creation as a profession where someone is doing it because there is a need in the market and no one is, serving that need. So you feel if I serve that need, I can become popular and I can make money on the back of distribution of that content. But I feel content is more a distribution game than a creation game. So maybe distribution can be bought on the back of capital, but even for someone to let AI create that kind of distribution, initially there will have to be some humans who are working and helping a computer build that kind of model. And I think that kind of intelligence or IQ and EQ, because virality requires a lot of EQ, understanding of EQ over IQ. Just for someone to put that in an algorithm, which is self-learning and pushing it, I think will exponentially increase productivity. So in the sense, if I read books or if I read a book to learn something, I can learn the same thing using videos, I can learn the same thing using audio content or podcasts, maybe much faster. I'll get to the insight much faster. It will be more engaging. But the reason I read books is not because I can't get that learning in some other visual mode, is because I want to focus on a mode which is meditative for me, that I can, if I sit down to read without any distractions, I will read for 3 hours and I will ensure that my attention span is in place and it's not reducing over a period of time. which is why I feel what will happen using AI is that one idea or mode of content will suddenly be replicable in innumerable languages and modes for consumption, but people can still choose which mode they choose to use for their learning better or more efficiently for different use cases. Now, also looking at the fact that, I was reading about this the other day, that when it comes to deciding on prices for concerts, like imagine it's a Selena Gomez concert, and, you know, they were to run a survey and check from people, what kind of money would you be willing to pay for one ticket of the concert? You know, if you were to plot that data, you will get a bell curve where, say, most number of people say that I'm happy to pay $100 in ticket for this. So one way of pricing is that you price the ticket at $100 so you feel maximum people can come in. But a more intelligent way of maximizing revenue is understanding that it's an 80-20 Pareto principle game. So rather than having just one ticket price, you should have a tiered ticket price, because, you know, more than 80% of your revenue is going to come from 20% of your fans or super fans, so to say, in this example, which is why you have passes which say that if a normal pass is for, you know, $100, there is a $500 pass or a $1,000 pass in which you can get pictures clicked with the star and, you know, party with them backstage and do all of that. And that's where the maximum revenue comes from. If you were to look at content creators, for a lot of people, they would be willing and wanting to go and then meet the content creator in person or have a live conversation with the content creator. And when it's a human, you know, suddenly the trust factor of someone or relatability factor increases. At this point, we are really amazed by what AI can create in terms of textual language and whatever. But I feel, you know, the reason why handmade products sell at a premium is because you know that you can do something which is built on the back of technology is definitely has more finesse, has more perfection, has more efficiency. But still, handmade has been able to position in a way where it has its own premium and charm. The same analogy holds very true in the industry of watches, where when quartz movements came in sometime in the 1970s in Japan, that's where it probably started. Suddenly the world was flooded with quartz watches because they were better at timekeeping. You could put in a battery and, you know, you didn't have to wind your watch. But now if you look at it, mechanical watches get so much more premium really because of the sheer fact that they are mechanical and you can wind them. You know, there's this whole charm of someone has actually assembled all the gears together and it's not run by battery. So I think those differentiating factors even in content will come in. Humans creating content will definitely be more relatable and will charge a premium, and people after a point will actually be okay with, yes, AI can create something so magnificent. I think people will realize, yeah, it's very normal for computer to be able to do it, but we want to see a human do this. And if a human does this, then we are really excited. So I think humans will find ways to kind of amuse themselves, and there is always an opportunity to make money.
So how scary is this AI and the tech development, given that we are trying to solve the minutest of our problems today? So on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you to lose your job in the near future?
I think this is something I always say, that the half-life of every career at this point is less than 5 years. So whatever skills you have today are going to be irrelevant in the next 5 years, and, you know, a computer will be able to do it. So that notwithstanding, I think being scared is a function of, are you the only person who will be disrupted, or will it be an army of people who will be disrupted? So I think that paranoia is great if it pushes you to upskill yourself in the right direction. And I think that little amount of scare is good because it creates that pressure to keep going and keep creating value in yourself and those outside of you. So that's something I'm really excited about. And if it's scared, if it's going to happen with the whole of humankind, I mean, why worry about it? Like, everyone has to figure out their way. So I feel I am actually more than scared. I'm actually excited because I feel that there are so many new waves which are going to come up in the economy, so many new industries and markets which are going to develop. So even if you're born with absolutely no inheritance, but you can upskill yourself and prepare yourself for the right trend to come, there are so many more exponential opportunities to create massive wealth. So I think that's what excites me more than scares me.
Yeah, and I think given the way Meta and Twitter and these guys are laying off people, that paranoia has kicked in and is going to stay for a long period of time. But any which way, talking about career upscaling and, you know, seeing ourselves 5 years down the line, let's go back a little in history. Could you like take us through your professional life? Like, so you achieved a lot at 23. How did your professional journey begin? And, you know, what was that one pivotal point in your life, that aha moment, that decision-making life? What was that one moment?
See, I don't know if I can, credit it to one moment. There have definitely been a bunch of defining moments. Which have led to certain mantras I attempt to follow in my life. I would hope God doesn't test me time and again so that I can prove myself again and again. I don't know how to phrase that, but imagine like one mantra I've tried to live by is face your fears. That anything that scares me, somehow there is this innate need for me to just be able to overcome that fear. So at one point, public speaking was such a massive fear for me that I would just not sign up for the school's debating society and, you know, all opportunities where there was public speaking and I had to speak in public in front of an audience. And I would just shy away and try to find whatever ways possible to not be in that position where I'm picked to do that. I think I recognized that and I felt really bad about it. So, which is why I consciously year on year, starting sometime around 2011, if I'm not mistaken, pushed myself into places where I could take up speaking opportunities from smaller audiences where I would feel confident enough talking about a subject where I was sure that the audience did not know about it, and slowly kind of building my confidence from there. So I've taken clear steps in achieving that. And now I feel happy that I can get on a stage and I've addressed audiences in thousands where, you know, I've been able to do it without blinking an eyelid and then being absolutely comfortable. That I think has definitely been a journey I'm very proud of and I'm happy I could undertake. I was extremely scared of writing, which is why to overcome it, I'd started a blog back in 2011 again. I wrote that for 5-6 years to the point where 2015, I got the Best Humor Blog of India Award by Bloggadda. So that for me was a defining moment where I was like, yes, I could overcome one or two fears in my life. Another fear was just opting out of placements at ISB. Everyone went to ISB. It was a very expensive education, probably the most expensive in the country. And people were like, we need an ROI on this spend on our MBA. And we need a package of, say, 35 lakh per annum or 40 lakh per annum. And there it was me coming from a very middle class family. Opting out and saying, okay, I'm going to build a business advisory and business consulting business all by myself. Not even attempting to see what kind of placements I could get. I think I'm very thankful to ISB that the dean that year gave me that option, saying that if you opt out and if you feel that you're unable to create something of value of your own for the next 2 years, you can come and sit for placements. So I'm very thankful that they gave me that kind of safety net to take that plunge and try it out. So I think at every point, there has definitely been an external support system which has propelled me or pushed me in the right direction. But facing one's fears, like wanting to face my fears, has been one mantra. The other is no regrets. Now, whatever has happened, you can't control what happened in hindsight. You can only look forward. So I'm just like, okay, whatever's happened now, what is controllable and uncontrollable, whatever is controllable for the future, let's try and optimize for that. These are, I think, two things. So yes, ISB not opting for placements and deciding to do my own business consulting. Huge inflection point. Deciding to write the blog, huge inflection point. Deciding to get into public speaking, huge inflection point. deciding to get into investment banking without any prior experience and wanting to learn through books and taking up assignments for free for certain startups just so that I could get an opportunity to learn. And at times initially also faking it, saying that, yeah, I know how to do it, and then getting that assignment and then just, you know, working really hard to understand it and deliver on it. I think all those things have really added up. And I'm very thankful for those opportunities and that environment, really.
Talking about your book, could you walk us through a summary?
Sure. So the book is called Daily Coffee and Startup Fundraising. And the entire ideation, the process, the distribution, everything was planned as per frameworks that I've given in the book on how a business model is to be thought through. So, you know, a business model is first ideated based on what kind of consumer need is unmet in the market that you want to plug. So how the idea for the book also came about was that two most commonly asked questions on my Instagram and LinkedIn DMs are, can you recommend a book where we can learn all of this? And can you help me with my startup fundraising? So I would recommend, and I continue to recommend, a lot of books on my social media on what I read and what I learn from them.
Yeah.
I felt these two are most commonly asked questions. I need to come up with a solution for this, which is why the book came about. So the target customer was someone between 20 to 35, 40, like that age group, and not necessarily having any background in finance. Like, 4 months, we could push it out, and very proud of what it's come to. We're almost done. We've sold out the first batch. There are just a few copies left now, and we're looking forward to the second edition, which is going to be new and improved. So I think this is probably going to be the fastest move to a second edition that any book has had, because we just launched about a month and a half ago, and we're already looking to push out the second edition in the next month.
Superb. I think that's a great transition and an exponential journey in itself, I feel. So, yeah, I mean, compounding, it works in mysterious ways in all fields.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. And I think the startups and your professional journey are a match made in heaven, because I think you are definitely made for this thing. Coming back to the topic, I think Indian startup ecosystem is facing one of its biggest fears, and that is the recession, that is the global recession that is going on. Do you think that is an arranged marriage between the startups and the recession, because you'll have to face that? And what is the mantra to keep the ship sailing during this difficult phase in the near future?
You know, just one of my videos, in fact, today that I put out online was on, if you look at what do they feed chicken to grow them unnaturally. They feed them soybean and some form of steroids, so that overnight or in a matter of 2-3 days, the chicken can grow to a size which otherwise it would take weeks to get to. And that's because of capitalism and, you know, wanting to get that chicken out to the market fast so that it can be slaughtered. I feel a lot of times capital, if used excessively without caution or discipline, also becomes a drug for founders and for businesses, because it's fueling excessive growth. And in that growth, they're not looking at efficiency and sustainability. They're just looking at, okay, we've got this money, quickly burn it and get to a result so that it gives us market share. Not realizing that, you know, culture is not a one-day thing. Once you get capital and you get it to burn over an 18-month period, you know, if habit forming happens over 90 days, you can imagine what will happen if a startup has money to burn for 18 months. You know, that's almost 500 days. So 90 day for habit forming and 500 days of just excessive capital to burn. Of course, a founder will absolutely forget what it is like to use financial discipline and build something with efficiency and hold restraint on capital and use of capital for his team. However, I think it also permeates from the top, because VCs would tell startups just quickly burn and get to that milestone. So the founder is pushing his team for it. But someday when that capital dries up, suddenly no one in the system has learned how to build it sustainably over a slow period of time. Now, I believe it's a double-edged sword, because we're also living in a time where people want speed is of great value because tech is changing so exponentially. And I think beauty lies in just balancing the two. So I think this recession is probably going to force the startups and the founders who learn to balance it now very well, because we can have amazing businesses come out of them. And as capital has its own cycles, you know, highs and lows, it's important for businesses also to go through this to test out how sustainable they really are and if they can go through, you know, economic cycles, which is why I feel it's a blessing in disguise. I am an investment banker. I make money when startups raise capital. So definitely I feel, you know, our business is also going to be heavily impacted. But I also see this as an opportunity because I'm learning now when these businesses are going to be impacted. There are so many people coming into, you know, entrepreneurship because of these layoffs. Bunch of these people will try something of their own. So if the IB vertical is not working, the need for business advisory vertical will only go up because people will want solutions as to how do I grow my business now that capital is not there. So, you know, I look at the silver lining from that perspective. And yeah, I mean, there's, you know, some of the best fund managers have actually made lifetime worth of wealth in downward cycles. So I feel it's about how you look at it.
Yeah, I mean, working in the PMS and AIF industry, I am literally observing this very closely, how few fund managers have like taken advantage of the drawdowns the markets have witnessed, right? But I love how beautifully you curated the particular analogy of, you know, habit forming and cash burning at startups. I mean, we're witnessing that today, like a lot of tech startup, the rally of IPOs that had come up, you know, in the Indian bourses about a year ago, are today witnessing most of these companies are, you know, coming to an end with the lock-in. So we are witnessing how these prices are falling drastically because of that investor fear that's coming or because of the financial impact that's going to come in. But great, I think it was a great flow of conversation we've had so far. I think keeping our time in mind, we can just wrap up this conversation with our signature rapid fire round. So yeah, I think I'll start with the first word. First word being the word of the episode, startup culture.
Discipline. Requires
fundraising.
Daily coffee.
Investing.
Wealth preservation. Because I feel there are two aspects to investing. Wealth creation and wealth preservation. A lot of times people think of it only as wealth creation, but not as a wealth preservation tool. And that is where they also end up making a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
Taxes.
Unavoidable.
Elon Musk.
Inspiring for his daredevil attitude. I mean, that level of fearlessness is just something I feel if I had, I would hope I'd be kicking ass. Like it's a great deal of risk, but that fearlessness is just kick ass, man.
But I think that fearlessness also counts with the amount of power you hold at the end of the day, of right? I mean, if we were in that position, we would all be fearless.
Correct. See, what you said is explaining a flywheel.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But at some point, it has to start, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that he could start it in his life at whatever point he did is just inspiring in its own self.
CFO.
Necessary. I am just astounded by the number of startups even at Series B who don't have a full-time CFO. And you know, at Series B is a time when you really need a full-time finance guy just planning this. And those CEOs are donning so many hats. The founder is the COO, he's the CEO, he's dealing with the investment banker, he's doing so much. I feel really bad for those founders because imagining how burnt out they must be.
Okay. Indian markets.
Miles to go before we sleep.
ISB.
Year of transformation. That's the phrase ISB uses to describe itself and can't be like better expressed or explained.
Okay. The last one from my side. Technology.
Equals industry. You know, at one point, industry would have. You're in healthcare, you're in finance, you're a manufacturer, you're a trader. These days it's fintech, health tech, ed tech, you know. So tech is now industry, it's the world.
Yeah.
And the last one from my side is Sarthak.
Blessed. And I feel that that's the word. I think a lot of things in life probably didn't deserve. So I definitely feel like God has been very kind. I've been extremely lucky.
Thank you so much for being a part of this episode. We have seen a lot of pivotal points in the Indian startup ecosystem, which you have rightly pointed out. And you have also taught us to, you know, embrace our fears where it is required the most and start up early. Just thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Darshan and Charmi. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you.